Welcome to Discovery 1 Revision, because this doesn't have a number. Now, before I get started, does anybody have anything they would like me to go over? Do we want to be crawling up and down the OSI reference model? Do we want to be talking about the differences between routers and switches? Or do we want to see what happens when you plug a Cat 5 into 240 volts and see your switch go bang? I would not recommend that. Don't try that at home, kiddies.
Oh, if you're going to do a demonstration, I want to see number 3, but I was going to say number 1.
Okie dokie. OSI reference model, we're crawling up and down, I think. I think was number 1, wasn't it?
It was.
Okie dokie. We can certainly do that. OSI reference model. 7-layer model. It has 7 layers. That's right, 7. Count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Depending on which way up the model is, depending on how you're looking at it, the application layer can either be at the top or it can be at the bottom. Now, for our example, the application layer is going to be at the top, and it is going to be considered the top of the OSI reference model, and the physical layer is going to be down the bottom. At this point, Geraldine would sing Let's Get Physical. There are 7 layers. 7. So if you've missed one, there's got to be 7. I'm just making that really, really clear. There are mnemonics for remembering the layers. From bottom up, it is please do not throw sausage pizza away. And from the top, it is all people seem to need data processing. Okay, but they're just mnemonics that are supposed to remind you about what they are. The bottom layer is the physical layer, and it concerns itself with cabling, wires, optical fiber, and radio waves. The next layer up from that is the data link layer, and it concerns itself with framing, error detection, and the actual bits and frames that are going onto the wires. Then above that we have the network layer, which concerns itself with network addresses. I should say the data link layer is split into two portions, which we don't talk about, which is very much, which is called the media access control, which is the one that says how you're going to get onto the internet, such as CSMA CD, carrier sense multiple access with collision detection, or in the case of wireless, carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance. Then you have your LLC, which is your logical link layer, which consists of having your framing and your frame check sequences, which are also known as a CRC32. And there's a little talk on CRCs up on the website, if anybody cares, where Ian works a CRC example. Basically, you do a binary long division and take the remainder, but we don't go into that here. The network layer has network layer addresses, and they are usually set by the administrator or by the network subsystems, using either things such as a PIPA, automatic IP address allocation, address discovery, which is what we use on IPv6, or DHCP, or mechanisms such as that BOOTP and RAP. The MAC address of an Ethernet card is how many bits long?
48.
Yes, and the first 3 bytes, or the first 24 bits, are the what?
Device manufacturer's ID.
Yeah, I'll give you full marks. Organizational unique identifier. OUI. OUI for short. Organizational unique identifier. Now, and they are assigned to the manufacturers, and some manufacturers have a lot of them. I think Cisco has about 20 or 30 of them, and Intel has a stack of them, and Asus has a stack of them. And in fact, if you Google, you can actually find a text file, I've got an old copy at home somewhere, that will actually tell you who owns all of the organizational unique identifiers, so that you can actually look at who owns the card by looking at the first 3 bytes of the MAC address. Okay, how many bits in an IP address? IPv4 address?
32.
Any other answers on that? How many bits in an IPv4 address? Anybody other than Grace know the answer to this one? This is a question in your final.
No, it's gonna be 32 for sure.
It is 32. That's good. How many bits in an IPv6 address? Anybody know?
128.
That is correct. And they are written as 16. Hang on, let me think about this. 16. They're groups of four hex digits. And so that would give you 16 bits per group, which would mean that there is 8 of them. So you've got, yeah, groups of four separated by colons. And I can't figure out exactly... yeah, four groups of four separated by colons in hexadecimal.
I can't wait to learn how to convert those.
There are little calculation tools that do it for you, and there are little subnet calculators that you're allowed to use. It's not as bad as what you think. Basically, the prefixes just get bigger, so you've got get things like 2001:3D4A:4168/96.
Yeah, but I can't remember how to do it anymore.
okay, well that's all right. Now, network layer. We talked about the network layer, which is your sort of logical network addresses, such as IPX addresses, IP addresses, and stuff like that. It is responsible for addressing the packets and getting them from one end to the other, such as the routing. We then look at the transport layer, which is responsible for packet assembly, disassembly. If we're talking about TCP/IP, TCP works at the transport layer, whereas UDP works at the network layer, because obviously TCP is interested in packet assembly and disassembly and keeping a reliable connectivity stream. Above that, we have the session layer, which is responsible for the opening and closing of dialogues. Think of sessions like phone calls. You ring up, you open a session, you talk, you finish talking and you hang the phone up, so that's your session. Your presentation layer concerns itself with the presentation of data, such as the encoding and decoding of data. For an example, if you send an email message and you do a MIME attachment, it is the presentation layer that is responsible for encoding your binary data as Base64. And we can talk about what Base64 is if anybody cares, but there you have it. And it's sent over the email, because mail is only 7-bit clean. So when you send a file and you attach it in Outlook or Outlook Express, the default is to Base64 encode it, and there are actually reasons for that, and your file actually expands by 25% in size before it's emailed. So that's why you will often hit an email meg limit. It's not the size of the actual file you are sending, it's actually the size of the encoded version of the file, which is 25% bigger.
Okay, so I have a question about the TCP and UDP stuff, if that's okay.
There is no such thing as a stupid question.
Okay, so I don't understand why UDP would work on a lower level traffic or lower level layer than TCP would, because it seems like something that would be less interested in error correction. I thought the lower you went, the more error correction you got.
No, in fact, the higher you go, the more error correction you've got. What happens is there is error detection. Okay, there's error detection at layer 2, which is where you use your frame check sequences or your CRCs, which is on your Ethernet, and that's to stop frames from getting scrambled on Ethernet, because, I don't know, if you think about it, when you send stuff over a network, you're blasting billions and billions of bits from one place to another. And if any of those bits go wrong, you're going to have all sorts of weird errors that are going to creep into things. I mean, could you imagine if 1 in 15 files that you transferred over a network got corrupted? And I have actually seen this on bad hardware, these files that get corrupted before they go to disk, and it wasn't actually the network card, because the network card's got CRCs to protect against that. So yeah, I mean, can you imagine how many bits and bits and bits are thrown around on a daily basis? And you're going to find that people expect their data to get from point A to point B correctly.
Yeah. Okay. So the higher you get, the more error correction you get. All right.
Well, I'm finishing that off. I'm sort of working my way up here. So at the network layer, you've also got the network level cyclic redundancy checks on the packets that make sure that the packet hasn't been corrupted at the network layer. Well, actually, no, you don't. You've got those at the transport layer. Because when you've got TCP, you've got segments. And you actually have a frame check sequence for each of the segments so that you can tell when the segments come in whether or not the segment is corrupt, and that will tell you whether you need to do a retransmit. Now, if you look at UDP, it works at the network layer. You send the packet out, and the routing logic is responsible for making sure that it gets from one end of the network to the other. But with UDP, it doesn't matter if it gets lost. Well, it does, but it's up to higher-level protocols to actually give a damn. Whereas with TCP, it's important that your data gets from one end to the other, and that retransmission retry logic, all that sliding window stuff that we talked about, which I can go back over if we need to, I don't think it's in the final, to be honest, will actually allow the data to get reliably from one place to the other. So basically, if you contrast two protocols, say for example HTTP and DNS, HTTP generally works on TCP and it runs on TCP port 80, and your website request goes out and then the data that you requested comes back on the TCP connection, and you want that to be 100% accurate. With DNS, however, the UDP packet is sent out, and perhaps the first one or two packets might get lost in the bitbucket in the sky, so to speak, and it will retransmit a few more times until it actually sees the responses from the DNS server, which are UDP packets, and they actually happen on layer 3 because it doesn't use that complexity of the transport layer to handle UDP. There are other protocols that use UDP, such as DHCP, NTP, which is the network time protocol, NetBIOS name resolution. Has anybody ever noticed how broken Windows Network Neighborhood or My Network Places can be on occasion?
Yeah, actually. Oh, on the XP machine.
Well, believe it or not, that is actually fixable. And you can actually fix it. But what it basically boils down to, and we don't go into this, is that it uses broadcasts, and it uses UDP broadcasts. So whether the machine sees the broadcasts or not will also tend to see whether things show up in the network neighborhood. The other thing that you'll find is that if you've got computers scattered across multiple work groups, it can sometimes be difficult to figure out whether you've actually got the browse lists collated for the various work groups. And often if you fix those problems and you fix the underlying causes, which is a bit of a black art, your network browsing becomes much, much, much better. And in fact, if you actually have a working DNS server on your network, all of a sudden network neighborhood actually becomes reliable and stuff, and connections to other machines happen in about half a second. Okay, so, and then the final layer, which I forgot to talk about up the top, is the application layer, which is the one that the applications all talk to. The applications actually talk to the application layer. So if we run an example, Grace has decided to send me an email to tell me that my lectures are the most boring thing she has ever heard in her life, and she's quitting the course. So she opens up her copy of Outlook Express, which is her mail program, and she starts typing this message. Dear loser, I find your courses incredibly tedious and boring, and I don't think I can handle another single lecture. Please excuse me from the rest of the term's lecture. Regards, G. And she hits the send button. Okay, so this message starts at the application layer. This is an example only, and in no way is she actually writing this message. And it travels down through the presentation layer, where she's decided to not turn off HTML. So she's got a plain text attachment and she's got an HTML attachment and stuff, so it's up to the presentation layer to make sure that that message is in the right format so that I can read it when it turns up in my inbox. It then travels, it opens a connection to her SMTP server, which will then send the message to me over the network using TCP port 25. It then travels, it gets packeted down into packets, into segments, I should say, and is sent over through the transport layer, which is TCP, and those segments are sent over the network layer, and the packets are routed to my mail server, and it's then sent down over the data link layer, which is the one where we have the frames and stuff, so they're the Ethernet frames, and it actually goes over the bits and the bytes and over the actual wires itself. It then gets to me, it comes in over the wires or over my ADSL or whatever I'm using for my mail server. It then goes back up to the frame layer, which is the data link layer, and it's decapsulated there. It goes back up through the network layer and it's routed to the machine that happens to be my mail server. It then goes up through the transport layer when the segments are reassembled and put back together. It goes through the session layer because that's the session, that's the SMTP connection that's been opened to my mail server. It then goes up through the presentation layer where the HTML attachments happen to be decoded and stripped off and stuff. And it then comes up through the application layer and it then goes and turns up in my inbox. Whereupon I sulk and resolve to make my lectures far more interesting. I then open my email program and compose a reply asking her very nicely that if I make my lectures really, really exciting, will she consider coming back to course? And then the same process happens again when I send the message back down to her. It goes all the way down through the application, presentation, session, transport, network, data link. Hang on. Application, presentation, session, transport, network, data link, and physical. I think I got them all. And then it goes physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application, and it turns up in her email program. So there's an example of the OSI reference model. And in this particular example, none of this stuff has ever actually happened except for the messages travelling through the OSI reference model. Any questions on that? Well, I find it always interesting that your average user has no idea of the complexities that go into data communications.
Yeah, it just magically shows up, doesn't it? I mean, yeah, like the Gates God just grabs it and it's there.
Oh, yeah, and in fact, and there's an interesting case on this, the postal system, I think, loses about 1,000 letters per year. But God help you if you lose an email. Now, is there anything else people would like me to go through, anything specific that people would like me to go through before I just start picking things? Are you all asleep yet?
No, I just got inspired for a second, sorry.
Oh, fair enough. What, to send me an email? Grin.
No.
That's alright, I'm just joking. Okay, okay, did anybody do the Busy Builders network exercise, or do I just sort of pretend that it was due next week?
I thought about it before I completely fell asleep for 3 hours this afternoon.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, look, if I'm just saying, has anybody done it? I mean, you haven't, that's okay. I doubt Scott has. Has anybody done the Busy Builders exercise? Oh, and silence was his only reply. No, that's fine. Okay, look, let me go through a couple of things regarding that exercise which might actually make it a bit easier for you. Okay? You've been given a specification that has said that each office needs a Class C subnet. Okay? How many bits, how many bits are in the network portion of a Class C address?
24.
That's correct. So before you even get started, pick out three Class C ranges of addresses and write them down on your bit of paper, because you've got three offices. Now, I've said that they're going to be on a VPN, and they're going to be unroutable. What is the default range of unroutable Class C subnets that are used for applications that will not be routed over the internet?
192.168.1.whatever.
Well, it's actually .x dot whatever. So 192.168 dot x dot whatever. So pick three types of x, maybe even 1, 2, and 3, or 20, 30, and 40, or 15,
so
35.
So I have to pick a different bunch of x. I can't just put them all on one x, which is what I was kind of going to do.
No. What happens if you put two machines on the same IP address? You get a nasty message popping up before you log in going, "Brink! You have put two machines on the same IP address."
Right, but if I have all of them on separate IP addresses and I'm still using the 192.168.1.1 through 30 for one office, and then 30 through 60 for another office, and then 60 through 90 for another office. Not that you could really probably do that, but just as a hypothetical example.
Each office needs three different subnets, as far as I can tell. They need the admin staff, they need the builders, and they need the servers and printers. So they actually need three subnets per office, and some of the subnets need 12 addresses on them. So you're basically going to use up pretty much half of a Class C doing this. So what I would recommend is, why make it difficult for yourself? Because these addresses are non-routable, give each office a different subnet so that when you're actually looking at the IP addresses of the machines in the office, you can see immediately based on the IP address as to which office they belong to. So one is central, two is depot, and 3 is whatever else 3 is. So 192.168.1 dot is for your main office, 2 dot is for your depot, and 3 is for the whatever I said the third one was. It's all very well and good to conserve IP addresses, and that's important, but if we're dealing with non-routable space, which you're not going to see out on the internet, you should make it as easy for yourself as possible. So to run an example, I have 3 subnets configured at home. I have 192.168.24, which is my main subnet, and that has all my servers and things on it. And the reason it's .24 was because we used to live at house number 24. That was the only reason. But it was a good enough reason. There is a virtual private network on a UDP-based virtual private network on 192.168.25.x. And there's a TCP-based virtual private network on 192.168.26.x. And I have all of those three subnets configured so that the VPN traffic is kept separate from the other VPN traffic, which is kept separate from the main server traffic. And then I basically handle all of that at the router and deal with those packets based on their IP subnet ranges so that I keep them all separate from each other. But because they're non-routable addresses, I can have one subnet, two subnets, or 10 subnets configured at home, and if I do it correctly, I'm not going to exhaust IP space because it all goes through a network address translator and you never see any of that complexity. You do see the, for those of you who are on my VPN, you do see my VPN subnet IP addresses, but obviously the routing is done transparently so that you can get it, well, almost transparently, I haven't quite fixed it yet, so you can get at all of the machines on my network. Okay, so you've got three subnets, so pick three Class C subnets. Figure out how big the subnets are going to have to be. Make sure you find the greater power of two that is bigger than the number of machines you want on the subnet, and set your subnet masks appropriate. Then slice up the separate Class Cs into the subnets and work out the binary as we've done the past 2 weeks. So that's pretty much a lot of the solution to that question, so I'll leave you guys to finish the rest of it yourselves, but that should give you a good running start on how to proceed in the next week or so. Okay, any other things people want me to go through? Anything that people are a bit confused on? I know somebody had a question, the difference between routers and switches. Now, switches work at layer 2 of the OSI reference model, or the data link layer, generally speaking, unless they're intelligent switches. And they use the MAC addresses, and they use a CAM, or a content address memory table, to figure out which machines are on which ports of the switch. And they can also use 802.1 spanning tree protocol and stuff to make sure that you don't have loops and things on the topology, and the switch learns which machines are on which ports, and it only sends either broadcast traffic to all ports, or it opens up micro segments between the different machines based on the MAC addresses that the machines are communicating to. So basically, that is working on layer 2, whereas a router works on layer 3, and it is responsible for dealing with IP addresses, subnet masks, and it deals with all of that subnet stuff that we have previously done over the last 2 weeks. Okay, what else am I going to go through? Everybody happy with wireless?
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, unless anybody's got anything else they want me to go through, I'm finishing early. Read your notes. Find out what you want to revise, because Otherwise, I won't run revision lectures. I'm not going to read through the final and give you all the answers, but I am trying to cover the most essential parts of the course. Make sure you're familiar with the troubleshooting stuff. Make sure you're familiar with the diagnostic stuff. Make sure you at least understand how the customer service stuff works. Make sure you know how to do your basic subnetting. Make sure you know how basically the stuff about the wireless, having the same ESS ID. Know your basic cable lengths, 10 base T, 100 base T, and 1000 base T are 100 meters long. Coax is 185 meters, although I don't think we cover coax anymore. And you also want to know about the wireless ranges, which is 100 meters or 328 feet. Oh, they still mention coax, do they?
Oh, yeah. It's probably one of those things that they just kind of briefly mention, and then they're going to hit you with it on the final because they figure nobody's reading that closely.
Not many people use coax these days. I'm surprised it's even still in there. Okay. And I think Module 4. I can't even remember what Module 4 was on. I know I didn't give a lecture on it, but I don't remember it being that complicated.
ISPs.
Oh, yeah, we figured most of you would have dealt with an ISP by now. Unless you're stealing your neighbour's wireless internet, which, of course, I wouldn't condone. Okay, well, I think we're done for today. If anybody's got any questions for today, ask now or forever hold your peace. Oh, is anybody interested in a Thursday chat next week on the law of attraction and universe theory?
I'll, of course, go.
Or are we more interested in a review of digital radio?
I think I can Google that one.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, we'll think about that. Sort of stepping out on a limb doing this one, but it may be interesting. We thought we might try that for next week's Thursday chat. We don't have a Thursday chat planned for tomorrow, so if anybody has any ideas, you can email Cavi Instructors, and we'll think about whether we're going to do it or not. But at the moment, there is no Thursday chat planned for tomorrow.